Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia,
mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has the devil put aside for me, for me, for me.
Welcome to the very first Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name is Barney Hoskins. I'm the editorial director of Rocks Back Pages. I'm sitting here with Mark Pringle, who is the chief archivist of the Rocks Back Pages online library.
Hello, Barney.
Beautifully delivered, Mark. We are here to tell you what is new on Rocks Back Pages this week. We're going to start with the great Freddie Mercury, about whom a biopic has just been released, the rather reviled, as far as I can tell, Bohemian Rhapsody, whose US release date is today, November 2nd. We are featuring an audio interview with the great Freddie from 1976 by Cream writer Robert Duncan. What did you make of it, Mark?
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, the sound quality isn't great, but it's certainly perfectly listenable. It's February 76. They're on the, what's the album?
Night of the Opera.
Night of the Opera tour, where they'd just been in America for about, maybe about 3 weeks, having toured the UK and Europe. Freddie comes over really well. He comes over as kind of fairly sweet guy, not a sort of braggart that one sort of imagines from his sort of stage persona. And he talks in quite good detail about the nature of the band, about their interestingly academic backgrounds, about the management problems they've had, and goes into quite a lot of detail on Bohemian Rhapsody. So it's a really good interview.
Are we going to listen to a little bit of Freddie talking about Bohemian Rhapsody?
Yeah.
Great. Let's do that.
Do you have any interest in making films, writing films, or something possibly based around a song?
That idea appeals to me as well, but it's something that's way in the future. I'd like to sort of put across, there's so much more that Queen can do at the moment. The nearest we've got to film is that we made a film of Bohemian Rhapsody, which was, coming back to your question, which is the nearest we've got something trying to put across that kind of musical feeling into a film of just us playing. I mean, obviously it wasn't this was. But even then, if you see this film, it's a step further. It's not just, you've got to see it. It's not just us performing. It's performing plus us in a very different mood, trying to put across this sort of the drama of it all. And it's sort of worked. 6 minutes of it.
Like stuff like Galileo come down.
Exactly. I mean, can you imagine how we would do it?
But an astronomer in the band, so I suppose that's.
It's just a. In the film, we've captured it. We've done it in a sort of operatic sort of content.
Parts of it are nonsensical. They're funny almost.
You mean the opera bit? Yeah.
The Galileo?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They are. So they're meant to be, you see. That's not for you. But they're meant to be. That's sort of, I wanted to use that certain, that section as just strict opera. But opera in the sense that a lot of, for the layman, you know what I mean? Because I didn't want to sort of put across the opera as a, I wasn't trying to tell people, look, this is an authentic piece of opera, which and I've done a lot of research into it. But that's silly, because I don't know that much of opera, but I was just trying to say, look, this is Queen's way of using operatic overtones in rock and roll, if that makes any sense. And therefore I had to use, call it cliches or whatever, and things like Galileo, and certain overused phrases in opera. Galileo's.
So what's the point to
create? One doesn't have to sort of keep to lyrical sort of format all the time. One can sort of, the thing I wanted to put across in that piece was just more drama and atmosphere more than anything. I wanted to create operatic voices and things. And in that sense, I think the lyrical content took second place. I was well aware of it. Yeah. I wanted to do that. I wanted, for that, I just did the words for the sheer sort of lyrical, not so much lyrical, the pronunciation sort of power than anything else.
The syllables.
Yes. Do you laugh? Did you laugh when you wrote that, or do you ever laugh when you wrote?
People laugh. I mean, I do laugh. I mean, when we sometimes come to the Galileo, especially because I got Roger to sing such, there's a very high sort of things. They can be. They are sort of at the point when we're actually doing them. It's quite possible. One must try and keep a straight face for the cards, because oh God, you know, we have done some silly things in our time, but I mean, that did take the cake. Because we did do something like 180 voices between the three of us, four of us. And after you've done no about 180 times, you feel you're in a lunatic asylum, and you feel, or is it all going to be worth it? But then it all falls together.
Okay, so that was Freddie Mercury talking about Bohemian Rhapsody, which at this point, February 1976, is only, well, it's less than a year old, isn't it? So it's an extraordinarily new and innovative thing, both in terms of the recording, in terms of the fact of the length of the song, in terms of the video.
Yeah, he talks actually, one point, what you've just listened to was Robert Duncan asked him, did he have any plans to make a film? He says, actually, no, we've just done one for this song. It's somewhat erroneously claimed that it was the very first rock video. Now, as we all know, that's simply not true. Stones and the Beatles and many others did promo films for showing on television way before that. But it is definitely, I hate to use the word iconic, but it's an iconic moment in the history of the music video, without a doubt. He goes into it in some detail, goes into the nature of the song. As I said, it's 6.5 minutes long, something like that.
Yeah.
The decision to release it at full length rather than butcher it, to release it as a single. It's good. It's very interesting stuff. So what you heard there was a taster, but it's about an hour long and there's a lot of really, really strong stuff in it.
Like you, I was surprised by how sort of serious Freddie is.
Yeah.
You kind of expect him to be, I don't know, a little
camp.
A little camper than he is. And, you know, he really talks very seriously about Queen as a group of four very different individuals.
Yep.
Also, sort of Queen is almost like a business.
I think very much like that's, as you know, if you listen to the interview, that's very much something that comes through. Is that because of their management problems that they had in the past, they've effectively, even though they have a manager, have become self-managing in so far as they've learned the insides out of the business. But not in a cynical way, not like, you know, this is all about making money and so on and so forth. It's just they want, it comes over very much from Freddie, is they want to create conditions whereby they can do their best work. He's also, he's touchingly sort of impressed by his colleagues' academic records. I mean, he goes on at some length about Brian May's astronomy degree and so on and so forth.
And leaves his art diploma to the very end.
Yeah, he does.
Great humility.
He briefly mentions it. I mean, the notion being that he's the only member of the band with an arts background.
Yeah.
While the others were all doing academic subjects and so on and so forth. So anyway, very
I really enjoyed it. He talks about Queen being sort of different, really, from any other rock bands, wanting to sort of appeal to a very, very diverse audience. And it reminded me, of sort of Bohemian Rhapsody being number one on Top of the Pops week after week after week, seeing that video over and over again. But also just the sort of, you know, kind of ambivalent feelings that I certainly had about Queen and probably still do have about Queen.
I think that's true. Interestingly enough, in the Roxback Page's office recently, we actually listened through to some of their earlier albums and realised what a great hard rock band they were. I mean, they could knock out very, very good, tough, hard rock. Bohemian Rhapsody, in a sense, was a sort of distraction from what I'd initially understood the band to be. I mean, I'm about them. Yeah, but I think they've always given me a degree of pleasure, and sometimes really great pleasure.
They could rock, as John Savage would say. They rock. And of course, you know, that brilliant moment in Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they just let go, and one always now thinks of the moment in Wayne's World where in the car rocks. But it really does rock.
Yeah.
And of course they could. I mean, they made some great pop singles. They were a sort of I mean, they were certainly inspired by Zeppelin, and he mentioned Zeppelin among the influences that Robert Duncan talks to him about. But anyway, I mean, look, I'd never sat down and listened to an audio interview with Freddie Mercury before. So for me, it was interesting. I think he was an extraordinarily compelling star.
I think also in the interview that, I mean, he deals with questions which he clearly has not a great deal of patience for very well. The thing about the audience is interesting, because I think that Robert Duncan was sort of implying that getting a very young audience somehow undermines the credibility of the band. And Freddie was having none of that, that he actually wants as broad an audience as possible. Welcome. I think it's one thing about Freddie Mercury is he genuinely loved his audience in a way that many stars don't. Mm. You can see him on stage in films and so on and so forth, and this is a guy who absolutely adored playing to an audience, and I think he really genuinely loved his audience in a rather special way.
Yeah.
Shall we get on to the new homepage?
Well, I was just going to, in fact, the segue that occurred to me is that among the influences that Freddie talks about is Joni Mitchell. He mentioned, everybody seems to mention Joni Mitchell,
indeed,
don't they? So even Queen were influenced by Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
And as it happens, Joni is 75 next week. And so, for a number of reasons, we are celebrating that on the RBP homepage with four items from the RBP archive. This ties in with the fact that we actually published a collection of interviews and reviews a couple of years ago, but it came out in America last year, called Reckless Daughter. It's a Joni Mitchell anthology, essentially, from some of the very first stuff that was written about her when she was performing, you know, like the Troubadour in LA, right up to, you know, the most recent interview that she gave. So, you know, we are great Joni fans in the RBP
office. We certainly are.
We listen particularly to Court and Spark a lot, don't we, Mark?
Yep.
And one of the items that we've selected for this week for the homepage is a review of Court and Spark by Michael Watts, one of the very best melody maker writers of that era. And I think that Court and Spark certainly, along with Hissing of Summer Lawns, remains my favourite period of Joni. What's your take?
Well, I mean, actually, for me, it was a love affair record. I was seeing this, I was just about to start art school. It was the summer before I started at art school. And whilst I'd been at an education, further education college, scraping together enough O-levels to get into art school, we made a trip to Brittany and I met this woman, and I spent part of that summer commuting back and forth. And that record became sort of the record of that, curiously, of that relationship, even though it bore no relationship to it whatsoever. Very important record for me. I mean, I'd listened to Joni before. I'd kind of liked Blue a bit. But, you know, I mean, I'm talking about, let's say, I was 18 in 1974, up to that point, Joni was someone who girls listened to. That sounds a terrible thing to say, but, you know, the folky albums were sort of kind of things that the girls at school listened to. Court and Spark had so much more richness musically. There's really great musicians playing on it, really interesting and elaborate arrangements, beautifully played. And as a bloke, that gave me something to kind of get my teeth into, as a bloke who wasn't really a folk fan at all. So it was my gateway drug to Joni, without a doubt.
Yeah, you were a free man in Brittany.
I was a free man in Brittany. Free man in Saint Malo.
Yeah. So we're actually putting together a Spotify playlist of 20 tracks to mark the occasion of Joni's 75th, and I think I've chosen six tracks, three from Court and Spark and three from Hissing of Summer Lawns. Mm-hmm. To me, those two albums are just sort of ineluctably conjoined, because it's some of the same.
You don't add Hajira to that list?
I think of Hajira as very different, actually.
Okay.
I do. It's Joni going in a different direction. So I love the sophistication, the richness, the textures, the chords of those two mid-70s albums.
Sure.
I do think they're among the greatest records ever made, actually. And I rather agree with you. I mean, actually, the first Journey album I bought was probably For the Roses. I was too young to buy blue. But I've never quite knelt at the altar of blue, as so many do.
No.
I mean, I don't know why. I just don't think it's as great as people say. I understand the kind of naked intimacy and confessionality of it.
I think that's true. I think the one thing that certainly Courtney Sparks is the first example of is we forget how great a musician Joni Mitchell was.
Yeah.
And in a way, the way she was before sort of downplayed her own abilities and imagination. And Court and Spot was the first record where she was kind of saying, actually, no, this is who I am.
Mm.
I can not only can I play, I can get other people to play and produce really interesting textures and really interesting sort of music. So, yeah.
And, of course, there was a sort of reaction, if almost a backlash, to this very different kind of Joni that she was presenting. I mean, the album Hissing of Summer Lawns was not very well reviewed in Rolling Stone, for example. I think they called it the worst album of the year. And I remember when I interviewed her in, I think it was 1994, you know, there was this idea that she had no right to sing or write about kind of affluent people in Malibu, for example. And those albums are very, I mean, Court Spark is very LA, very Beverly Hills,
entirely.
It's very Malibu. You know, and there was that picture of her in the swimming pool in Hissing of Summer Lawns, and people were like, this is, Joni has somehow, it's like Dylan going electric. And not seeing she's sort of abandoned us, she's betrayed us. And I remember her saying to me, do you know, I mean, I'm a writer, and I think I can write about whatever I want to write about. It doesn't mean that I necessarily approve or endorse people, the lifestyles of the rich and famous. But this was my new environment.
I think you can also add to that, there was a sort of sexist component in that.
Absolutely.
That as a woman, she was only believable to men if she was like barefoot in the kitchen in her Laura Ashley dress.
Mm.
And the moment she starts sort of appearing as someone with money, with time, with notions of luxury and all kinds of things like that, it completely undercuts that. I can't really develop that much further, but I mean,
I think you're right that Joni has, like so many female artists and musicians, struggled with sexism, and she was one of the first to really say, I am my own woman, and she intimidated a lot of men, and they didn't like it.
Yeah.
She worked her way through quite a few men who just simply couldn't really kind of cut it, I think. You know, in the Joni orbit. I mean, from Graham Nash through to, I don't know, John Guerin, who's the drummer on these albums we're talking about. You know, I mean, and she's a spiky character, there's no doubt.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
Well, I have to say, the woman that I talked to for I mean, I think almost 2 hours back in the 90s, was extremely charming, vivacious, funny, and even flirtatious. I really liked
Good
her
grief.
Enjoyed her. Yes,
there,
I know.
There, but
I could have
grief.
Been... Yeah. Anyway, moving swiftly on, as you like to say. Shall we just, en passant, let us note that every week on Rock's Back Pages, we feature one of our writers. We call this Spotlight Almost Famous after the Cameron Crowe film. And this week we are featuring the great Adrian Devoy, who is really one of the very best writers from that kind of batch of Q guys and girls in the 80s and 90s. And we're very pleased to have Adrian on board. He came on board probably 2 or 3 years ago. So we actually got one of his very earliest pieces, not for Q, but an interview that he did with Morrissey and Johnny Marr from 1983 from that magazine. I can't even remember. It's called International Musician.
International Musician.
International Musician.
Yes.
Horribly designed, dreadful covers, but maybe that's where Adrian got his kind of foot in the door. And then a piece I remember really enjoying from Q from 1994, where he managed to get Björk, PJ Harvey, and Tori Amos together around a table or in the same room, a sort of summit meeting between these three extraordinary talents. Well, I certainly am a huge Björk and PJ Harvey fan, slightly less so of Tori Amos, but I think Björk and Polly Harvey are two of the most extraordinary female, you know, writers and artists that pop music has produced. So, and then finally, an interview with Lionel Richie from 2015 for The Mail on Sunday, for whom he regularly contributes. repeat.
I haven't read that. What? How does Lionel come out in it?
Lionel comes out really well. I mean, I think he sort of arrives, and I think Lionel's sort of getting out of his Beverly Hills swimming pool. he comes over very well, actually. It's a really good interview. So that's sort of what we're featuring free. The Joni stuff and Adrian's pieces are some of the free content on Rock's Back Pages. Why don't we look, Mark, at some of the pieces that you have overseen in terms of going into the library?
Sure. Let's start off in 1966. Dawn James. Dawn James is a wonderful writer. We're very glad to have recently got her on board Rock's Back Pages. She wrote for Rave and Mirabelle. And in a sense, she's less a music journalist than a personality interviewer, but she happens to be interviewing musicians. And I think it's immensely sensitive that she writes about their personalities in a detail which was very rare in the 60s, certainly at that point. Anyway, this is an interview with Keith Moon, where he actually comes over as a complete tit, frankly. He's a sort of the ghastly show-off at school that you just want to thump, and I think that's actually who he was in many respects.
Well, he's the original kid with ADHD,
and he just keeps making increasing some of the hyped-up statements in order to wind up Dawn. And she's, one thing about Dawn James is she's completely unflappable. So she sort of, you know, just takes it in her stride. Next thing I'd really like to, there's Max Jones interviews Aretha Franklin, which is in 1970, which is terrific. She's a difficult person to interview, but he gets quite a lot out of her. Very early interviews, the lovely, marvellous Bonnie Raitt, by Joel Selvin from the San Francisco Chronicle in 1972. Tony Cummings, great writer about black music for Black Music Magazine, does a thing on sort of the lower underbelly of the Philadelphia soul scene.
I want to just quickly interject and ask about the piece about Guy Piau, if that's how you pronounce it. Pele art, but his extraordinary Rock Dreams, which I mention it because it had such impact on me when I bought it when it came out in I believe 74 was just a sort of, it was such an interesting visual take on rock mythologies.
It certainly was. This is an Andrew Bailey interview with him for Rolling Stone in 74, as a book, I mean, again, my brother bought it when it came out, and he's particularly strong, and again, this is mentioned in this piece, on particularly the Rolling Stones. He kind of keeps revisiting the Rolling Stones throughout the book, and at the time, Rolling Stones were still at sort of the height of their devilish mythology before. In fact, as it happens, they were on the slide by then, but they're very much central to this book. It is an extraordinary piece of work.
Well, that incredible picture of them in sort of stockings and suspenders, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which was really sort of, was it really did stick in the mind. But I lost my original copy and rebought it in one of those secondhand stores on the Charing Cross Road, I think it was, or maybe it was Record and Tape Exchange. I loved the book. I still love it.
Very interesting. I mean, for me, in fact, again, it's mentioned in the interviews, Diana Ross in a limousine, completely kind of glittery and shiny, and through the windows you see the black ghetto and people standing on the street corners.
Brilliant.
I thought that was terrific at the time. And actually, having done this, I went and looked back through my copy after proofreading this interview and found it fascinating.
Yeah.
Moving on, 1979, Sylvie Simmons sees The Runaways at Whiskey A Go-Go. I learnt after I proofread it, she talks about bad atmosphere in the dressing room, it not being a great show. It was actually literally one of their last shows. I think they played two more shows after that before they broke up.
Right, which is at this timely because, of course, the Joan Jett documentary, Bad Reputation, has just come out.
Yep. Jesus and Mary Chain, very early interview by Neil Taylor for the NME. They come out with some great quotable stuff. I have a certain fondness for the Jesus and Mary Chain. A long interview with Randy Newman by Mark Rowland from 1988 and musician. Randy Newman always gives great interviews. He's just such an interesting man.
He certainly does. I've been privileged enough to interview him twice. He is a delight. And I actually pulled The Paul quote that we feature on the homepage every week comes obviously from one of the new pieces. This seemed to be a very timely quote to Mark Rowland, 1988, when Land of Dreams came out, because Dixie Flyer is this extraordinary song about being a Jewish kid from Los Angeles, mm-hmm. who goes every summer to spend the holidays with his relatives right. in Louisiana, and it has all those extraordinary lines about doing what the Gentiles do. So there's this. So they talk about being Jewish in America, and this quote right on the back of the appalling shootings at the synagogue in Pittsburgh really caught my eye, and I know yeah. caught yours. To be Jewish in America is different. No one wants to be an American more than a Jew. Irving Berlin was more American than John Wayne. So we feature that prominently on the homepage this week.
Yeah.
And I've not read the interview apart from that quote, but I know it'll be great.
It is very good. He talks, in fact, in some detail about his relationship with the South and so on and so forth. Anyway, it's great stuff. Lastly, last thing I'd like to at least feature is Neil Kulkarni's marvellous review of Wu-Tang Clan's Forever, Melody Maker 97. Neil Kulkarni is kind of a favourite writer of mine. He's one of these people who just sort of goes charging off on sort of marvellous rants. He claims that this is possibly the greatest hip-hop album ever. I posted that on Facebook and he came back saying, well, I may have changed my mind slightly.
Well, there's been a lot of hip-hop albums since.
Yeah, but also, you know, he sees its faults now. It is overlong, it is sprawling and chaotic. But the sheer mad enthusiasm of his review is just really compelling reading. It's terrific stuff.
Well, we love the Wu-Tang, don't we?
We do.
We do. I know lots of kind of white... One of them, critics love the Wu-Tang.
One of them claimed to know me in San Francisco Airport.
We met them, didn't yeah. we?
And he said, I know you.
Well, this is a very bizarre encounter where we're waiting at the airport, San Francisco Airport, and we suddenly realised that in the departure lounge with us was most of the Wu-Tang.
Yes.
Not that I'd ever done a head count. But we did get into a conversation with U-God,
that was
who
it was.
Recently published his sort of memoirish book.
That's right.
Which Faber published. Yeah. I did find them. I just loved what DeRisa did musically.
Yeah.
I mean, quite apart from the sort of quality of the hip hop guys, the rappers,
yeah.
the Method Mans and so forth. I could listen to a lot of Wu-Tang just on the basis of what he does with sort of Southern Soul
yes,
samples,
yes.
which was really unusual at the time.
I think the other thing I find interesting about Wu-Tang Clan is that, whilst they were nationally huge in a huge musical form, they were actually extraordinarily local. I mean, they were Staten Island. They weren't part of the major sort of African-American urban centres of Atlanta or New York or Los Angeles and so on. I mean, Staten Island is technically New York.
Yeah.
But there is, which kind of is part of how they sort of developed almost this cottage industry approach to what they did, which they then extended when they moved to, Illinois and built... bought a farm or something mad like that. But I just find the dynamic of within them and of them really interesting. And yeah, you're right, they produce some lovely sounding stuff.
A couple of pieces that I'd like to just flag mm-hmm. up from the last sort of 20 years. One would be Mark Kemp was at one time the reviews editor, or he may have been features editor at Rolling Stone, and he then went on to very cushy job at MTV in New York. He is now back in, you know, his sort of home state of North Carolina,
yep, yep.
where he lives. So he's a Southern guy, wrote an amazing book called Dixie Lullaby.
Yep.
And until recently was the editor at Creative Loafing Online. And he wrote this piece about being at MTV in the real kind of heyday of the boy band era, when the Backstreet Boys roamed the land and the hearts of teenage girls. So it's from 2012, and it's a very interesting, fly on the wall piece about being right in the midst of that kind of hysteria. And then finally, there's a very, very, very long interview by Larry LeBlanc for Celebrity Access with Toby Maimis, who happens to be one of our writers as well. And Toby has an extraordinary career that takes in management, writing, journalism, publicity, you know, he's sort of, he really is a Zelig of the industry. He's sort of there, he's known everyone, he's worked with everyone. Most famously, you know, Alice Cooper. I think he's still involved in Alice Cooper's management. But he's sort of there in the background with John and Yoko around the White Panther, John Sinclair era. You know, he knew the New York Dolls. You know, I think the Runaways. I mean, he claims that he tried to get Kim Fowley to produce The Runaways doing I Love Rock and Roll, and Kim wouldn't do it because he couldn't get half a publishing. So Joan Jett, post-Runaways, ended up having this sort of ginormous hit with it. So you can imagine, going, Kim's probably still turning in his grave at the memory of that. But it's a great interview, and we're delighted to have both Larry and Toby on the site. We were joking earlier about Toby's, but we've got five writers called Toby.
I know.
And one of them's a woman.
There's only one Barney.
and I keep all the others out. So that's essentially what we're bringing live to you on Rock's Back Pages this week. So this has been us, Mark Pringle, and myself, Barney Hoskins, for Rock's Back Pages.
For Rock's Back
and
Pages.
For you. Thank you.
That was the Rock's Back Pages podcast, presented by Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle. The producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. You can find all the articles they talked about and thousands more, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
Looking to expand or move your company? Look no further than Ohio. With a talented workforce for in-demand industries like tech, healthcare, engineering, manufacturing, and more, you can staff up and scale for growth. Ohio's central location and reliable infrastructure will help you impress your customers. While Ohio's affordable cost of living and quality of life will excite your employees, why survive somewhere else when your business can thrive in Ohio? Visit successinohio.com today.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.